the U.S. and Iran reach a deal, a prisoner swap for access to cash, a diplomatic win with drawbacks.
The simple fact that we have any kind of deal where the freedom of certain people on one side is being weighed against access to financial resources on the other is a really depressing situation to be in.
Also ahead, 3 years ago, a powerful explosion ripped through Beirut. Some 200 people were killed. Parents of some of the children who died just want an acknowledgement from their government.
That's it. That's not a lot. It's a really low bar to ask for, and it's not being met.
I'm Carol Hills, plus the global women of hip hop.
The most innovation happening right now in hip hop is happening outside of America. And that's, you know, it's just the truth.
It's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The U.S. and Iran have reached a diplomatic breakthrough. Tehran has agreed to free 5 imprisoned Iranian Americans. In exchange, the U.S. will release $6 billion of Iran's frozen oil revenue. The money can only be used for humanitarian purposes. Esfandiar Batmanghelij is following all of this. He's the CEO of Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, a think tank focused on economic diplomacy in the Middle East. He joins us from London. Esfandiar, first, who are the Iranian Americans who were released from Evin prison and upgraded to house arrest? And what exactly were they accused of?
Based on the current reporting, we know 3 of their names, Siamak Namazi, Emad Shahi, and Murad Tahbaz. And there are 2 further individuals who I believe their names have so far not been disclosed. These are individuals that have been working in Iran in different capacities, but the reason that they were detained on unsubstantiated charges was because of an accusation of espionage, essentially, by the Iranian authorities.
So now they're being released to house arrest and then eventually coming back to the U.S. Is there an agreed-upon timeline for their return to the U.S.?
The current reporting suggests that there is an interim step between their release into house arrest and their arrival in Doha in Qatar. Qatar has been playing a role as a mediator in this deal between the U.S. and Iran. For its side of the bargain, Iran expects the United States to facilitate the release of $6 billion of historic oil revenues held at 2 banks in South Korea. And those funds are intended to be transferred from those banks to a bank in Qatar. That's going to take a few weeks. And when those funds do arrive in Qatar, the understanding is that that will be the point at which the individuals now under house arrest will be able to leave Iran and finally regain their freedom.
How was Washington able to block this money in the first place or freeze it? I mean, it's Iran's money and the U.S. doesn't have relations with Iran. How does that work?
It has to do with the extraordinary power of the U.S. in the global financial system. Technically speaking, even before this deal was struck, Iran was permitted to use this money for the purposes of humanitarian trade. That's a long-standing exemption that exists within the U.S. sanctions. But banks are very hesitant to do anything related to Iran unless they have specific guidance or a letter of comfort from the U.S. authorities saying that a given transaction is permissible. And the South Korean government, despite interceding on behalf of their banks, was basically unable to convince Trump and then subsequently Biden and their administrations in giving this green light. In the end, I think what is happening is that the U.S. has agreed to finally give the banks the necessary guidance that they need so that they know transferring the money from their accounts to the recipient bank in Qatar is not going to get them in hot water. But the final thing to, I think, really emphasize here is that for exactly the same reason that it took so long to get this money unblocked and that banks were hesitant to move without the green light of the U.S. authorities is the reason why the U.S. will retain an incredible amount of oversight ability over how this money is used. Not only is the money not flowing back to Iran, it's staying outside of the country, but the U.S. will be able to monitor each and every transaction made from the bank in Qatar when the funds finally arrive, and will be able to determine that the payments that are being made are exclusively for food and medicine.
Now, despite all the caveats you've outlined, some people are still calling this a kind of ransom or using the term hostage diplomacy. Do you think that's fair?
Look, I think we need to be very upfront that the simple fact that we have any kind of deal where the freedom of certain people on one side is being weighed against access to financial resources on the other is a really depressing situation to be in. We have to see this as a good deal, because ultimately what is being secured is the freedom of five Americans who don't deserve to be detained in Iran. And at the same time, the deal is very carefully structured to make sure that the financial resources that are being made available to Iran are being made available on the basis of very strict rules and regulations. This is not money that will be able to flow back to Iran to permit Iran to engage in the behaviors that the U.S. Considers problematic from a national security perspective. Iran won't be able to use this money for its military activities. It won't be able to use this money to fund terror in the Middle East. The money is tightly controlled. And I think that's exactly why this administration was willing to proceed with the deal. And so I think we need to take a step back, look at this soberly, and realize that it's a good deal to get Americans freed, and it's a limited deal for precisely the reason that the Biden administration is not changing its overall approach to Iran.
But is there a danger that this deal could embolden Tehran to grab more American citizens to see what it can get from Washington?
There is always a danger when it comes to Iran that certain elements in the Iranian government would see value in trying to engage in more hostage diplomacy of this kind. At the highest levels of the Iranian security establishment, there has been an agreement that after 2 years of difficult negotiations, they will finally come to terms with the United States around this prisoner swap and around the freeing of these assets. In my view, that represents a desire to de-escalate with the U.S. We're in a dangerous position where the nuclear negotiations have broken down and the U.S. and Iran don't have a very clear diplomatic understanding. So this agreement is one of the few sort of bright signs we have on the horizon that these two countries can, with their current political configurations, engage in negotiations, identify mutual benefit, and reach an agreement. And that's something to build upon. Now, the U.S., for its part, was not providing Iran access to basically its foreign exchange reserves for the purposes of humanitarian trade as sort of proactively as it should have been. It is not an exaggeration to say that the U.S. held those funds hostage on its side and thereby gained leverage that it was able to use in these negotiations.
It's so interesting. I mean, it appears there's some informal agreements behind the scenes also between Iran's government and the Biden administration on nuclear enrichment. What's going on there? And was that part of this overall discussion with this deal?
So as a colleague of mine has put it, we are in a phase of no crisis, no deal, meaning that neither side so far appears willing to go beyond this limited agreement and actually resume nuclear negotiations that would exchange significant restrictions on Iran's nuclear program for the kind of sanctions relief that had been provided in 2016 during the Obama administration. But given the fact that they are unable or unwilling to achieve that kind of bigger deal, they still appear really keen on avoiding a deeper crisis. The Middle East has been roiled by crisis for a decade. We see this when we look at the diplomacy being undertaken by countries like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Iraq. Governments in the region are trying to lower the temperature. And a big part of that is actually getting the U.S. and Iran to have some level of understanding that they're not going to let a cycle of escalation begin that drags everyone to the brink of a bigger conflict.
Esfandyar Batmanghelidz is the CEO of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, a think tank committed to economic diplomacy and development with a focus on Iran. He's been speaking to us from London. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's turn to Lebanon now. It's been 3 years since a massive explosion ripped through the capital, Beirut. Improperly stored ammonium nitrate ignited the blast. Neighborhoods were leveled. Some 220 people died. Still today, survivors and families who lost loved ones have been searching for answers. And a warning, the content of this next story may be disturbing for some listeners. The Royal Shirin Jafari reports.
August 4th, 2020 started like any other day for Sarah Copeland. She, her husband, and her 2-year-old son, Isaac, had moved to Beirut a year before. Isaac was in his high chair, ready for his dinner. It was 6 in the evening.
And I heard a loud bang, which I now know was the first explosion.
Copeland walked over to the window to see what was happening. In that time, a second explosion happened, the massive one that shattered all the windows and threw her to the ground. Her husband rushed in.
And we heard Isaac crying, and we soon figured out that he was quite injured.
A large piece of glass had pierced through his chest, Copeland says. They rushed to get him to the hospital. But the whole city was impacted by the blast. Hospitals themselves were damaged. Roads were blocked. Nothing was working. On that day, another mother was also desperately trying to save her child. Seema Jilani's 4-year-old daughter, Iman, was injured in the blast too.
It's mass pandemonium. That one ambulance we see is sort of just stuck there, and it is filled to the brim with people.
Jilani, a physician herself, wanted Iman to stay awake, but she also wanted to calm and soothe her.
So I said, you know, our favorite place is the beach, right? So if you feel some warm water dripping on you, you just think that we're at our favorite beach in the world and just pretend that we're relaxing there.
Iman had deep wounds on her body. The one on her left hand was so deep, Jilani says, she could see her bone. When they got to the hospital, Jilani says, there was so much chaos, she offered to help. Copeland and her son were separated when they got to the hospital. Copeland was almost 7 months pregnant, so she needed immediate care as well.
I had a big piece of glass in my face, which I didn't actually realize at the time. Even, you know, I was just so focused on Isaac. And then they took me off to a separate room to treat me. And that was the last time I saw Isaac. He died shortly afterwards.
Iman, the 4-year-old, survived, but it took her a long time to recover, Jilani says.
We all had some measure of acute PTSD where we wouldn't be able to sleep. It's 3 years on, and that is still ever present. There was some thunder the other day, and I immediately ducked.
Last Friday, people marched in Beirut holding up pictures of those who were killed in the explosion. Firefighters, passersby, residents who lived close to the site, young, old, and children. These families want those who were responsible to be held accountable. In the wake of the explosion, the Lebanese government started an investigation.
The investigation has really been marked by a series of stalls, of political incursions.
Margaret Satterthwaite is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers. She says those who've been implicated in the case have recused themselves. The judge leading the investigation has received death threats. In March, Satterthwaite wrote a letter to the Lebanese government expressing concern. But so far, she says, she hasn't received any answers.
This is really, in many ways, the big case that is testing the judicial and legal system of Lebanon right now. All eyes are on it, no question. And if this case itself can't be brought to fruition, I'm afraid to consider what that might mean.
Meanwhile, as each anniversary passes by, survivors wonder if they will ever get any justice. Sarah Copeland, who lost her son, says she has no faith in the investigation in Lebanon. She has been working with others to push for an independent UN fact-finding mission. In the meantime, she remembers Isaac as a lively, funny little boy, one who could count to 25 in French by the time he was 2 years old.
He was just everything to us. He was our absolute world. I could probably talk forever about Isaac. We thought he would be something special, do something special with his life, and it's just kills us every day that he was robbed of that opportunity.
Copeland says the time and energy she and other families have spent trying to understand what really happened and who was responsible is time they could have spent grieving and rebuilding their lives. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Ecuador continues to grapple with the assassination of presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio. Late yesterday, the Ecuadorian Attorney General's Office confirmed that 6 suspects have been arrested They're all Colombian. So too is the suspected shooter who was killed by law enforcement. Elizabeth Dickinson is a Colombia analyst with the International Crisis Group. Elizabeth, police say the suspects belong to criminal groups. What kind of criminal groups?
Well, what we know about the suspects so far, basically, is that they have a series of previous charges in Colombia for crimes ranging from robbery to homicide, to drug trafficking. What we can say is that they're from a context in Colombia with a long history of organized crime with links to drug trafficking.
Do we have any sense at this point what the motive was for the killing of Fernando Villavicencio?
You know, we don't. And I think this is very important to sort of wait and see what we learn from the investigation.
Ecuadorian law enforcement said they found a rifle, a submachine gun, 4 pistols, 3 grenades, all in the possession of the suspects. What does that signify to you?
We've seen a very interesting phenomenon in recent years, in fact, in which drug that's being exported from the Pacific coast is not being paid directly in dollars, but rather in arms. And so the level of sophistication of the arms trade and the arms that are moving into this region is really something that is new and has changed the level of violence and the sophistication of violence that these groups are able to exercise.
Hmm. Ecuador shares its northern border with Colombia. How common is it to hear about Colombians involved in criminal groups working inside Ecuador?
Well, so one of the unfortunate results of Colombia's long civil war, half a century really of conflict, is that there is a large, quote unquote, talent pool of people with an experience in exercising violence, in running trafficking routes. And I think particularly after the government of Colombia signed a peace agreement in 2016 with the largest leftist insurgency known as the FARC, there were a lot of free agents. But it's simply a reality that there is this pool of individuals who now understand how to utilize violence in this context and are available for hire.
It was Colombian mercenaries who were involved in the assassination of Jovenel Moise in Haiti, right?
That's right. Although there is a very clear difference in the sense that many of those individuals were former military, retired soldiers, people who had an experience in the security sector. And in this case, we seem to have individuals with a long history of crime. So it's in some ways a similar phenomenon, but on very different sides of the conflict.
The upcoming election in Ecuador, I think it's on August 20th, that's been very much about controlling the growth of violent crime, which is on a steep rise in Ecuador. Fernando Villavicencio, who was assassinated, he was very vocal on this matter. How might his assassination change the election?
Well, what I hope is that this really opens up a conversation. We in Colombia have been grappling with this topic for decades, and it's not an easy one. And I think one of the important junctures is the ability to have the public debate about what's happening and what the response needs to be. I think this will be a pivotal moment in the electoral debate about, you know, the gravity of the threats that Ecuador is facing. I hope that it's also a moment in which the region can really show solidarity.
Well, is there any evidence that Colombia is working with Ecuador on the investigation of this assassination?
Exactly, there is. So this investigation is being carried out jointly between the police of Ecuador, the FBI in the United States, and the police in Colombia. I think this is key that we have this cooperation, and also from the U.S., frankly, which will bring a level of sophistication to the investigation. That's really important.
Elizabeth Dickinson is a senior analyst on Colombia for the International Crisis Group. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
This summer, we've been stepping back a bit from the news of the day to bring you some stories from the stage, tales from ordinary people with extraordinary experiences. They're produced by our partners at the GBH TV network World. Today's story is from Biar Khan, a Sudanese man who grew up in a Kenyan refugee camp.
At 17, I was ready for the biggest moment of my life, sitting for my national examination. But I've lived in a refugee camp since I was 3 months old. But now that I moved to Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, I'm excited to join better schools. But that is when I was told, in order for you to sit for your national exam, you need your birth certificate. But unfortunately, for a lot of us who are refugees, we didn't have them. Then the family told me the only way I could retrieve my birth certificate was to go to the Sudanese embassy. I found myself on the busy street of Nairobi, looking for the embassy, asking strangers for direction. After encountering about six strangers, none knew where the embassy was. But then I was stopped by an older woman with this beautiful curly hair. She spoke to me in Swahili, which is the national language of Kenya, and asked, "Are you okay? Are you looking for something to eat, direction, or a place to stay?" That is when I realized she thought I was homeless. It's not uncommon in Kenya to see homeless people on the street, even children asking for food and money. I smiled and I told her, "No, I wasn't looking for something to eat. I was actually looking for the direction to the embassy." And she smiled. She said the embassy is down the block, and she offered to walk me there. We had a conversation, and she told me, "The reason why I stopped you is because I'm a mother first, before anything. And as a mother, I feel obligated to help in any little way that I can when I see a child on the street." That then reminded me of my mother. Even when we were in a refugee camp and had little to nothing, she always shared with those who did not have. Went to the embassy. I told her thank you, waved goodbye, got my birth certificate, registered for my exam, and it all went well. 3 years later, I was relocated to the United States of America. One thing I didn't actually expect to see in America was the homelessness. When you live in a foreign country, America is seen as this beautiful country, one of the best, if not the best. So you would never think to see a homeless person in the United States. One morning while I was going to school, an incident happened when I bought my coffee. I saw a young man who looked very tired and had this wad clothes, asking this young lady for some change. But the lady, instead of helping him, she was rude and started insulting him. I was shocked, and the young man had a stony face on because he felt humiliated. When the young lady walked away, I approached him and offered him one of my Dunkin'. And I told him, "I know how it feels to sleep with an empty stomach. I know how it feels to be hungry, because I was once a refugee, and in a refugee camp, you have to rely on the generosity of others." On my way back to school, I thought of the woman, that woman in Kenya, the woman who was so eager to help me, even though she didn't know me, and she taught me a very important lesson. She told me, even though we might not always have the money to spare to other people or the homeless people, we can always give them the most important thing, and that is our time. Because they are human before anything, and that we should always treat people with respect and dignity.
B.R. Khan with his story of kindness and passing it on. Find more of these storytellers at worldchannel.org. You're listening to The World. Across Southeast Asia, North Korean restaurants have long been a hot ticket. It's bulgogi with a show.
What they're actually selling is proximity to North Korean entertainers, playing guitar and keyboard and performing very well-known songs.
But now these popular restaurants are shutting down. We'll tell you why ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Happy birthday, hip-hop. You've made it to 50 and show no signs of stopping. In fact, if you've been tuning into the show lately, you know that hip-hop globally is only growing and getting stronger and more urgent. All summer, for our series Planet Hip-Hop, we've been exploring the global ripple effect of a neighborhood party that took place exactly a half century ago in the Bronx. Today, on its 50th birthday, we're going to hear from the women of hip-hop. Here's my colleague Marco Werman with more.
We're talking female rappers who help nurture the sound.
Light as a rock, or I should say a boulder, rolling down your neck, pounding on your shoulders. Never shall I be an MC called a wannabe. I am the light, L-Y-T-E. This is
and the gave the expression a different voice.
Mm-hmm.
showing their male counterparts that they're just as important, talented, and influential. To help us navigate the ways women have helped shape hip-hop is Sia Kabona-Clark, Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of African Studies at Howard University in Washington. She also hosts the Hip Hop African podcast. Professor Clark, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
So the big hits in the early days were almost exclusively from men. I'm curious, when you started digging into hip hop and appreciating it, who was like the first truly global female rapper, a pioneer in the genre, and what message was she sending to young women in parts of Africa, Asia, or South America?
Gadessa from South Africa, they were the first recorded group out of South Africa. They're based in Cape Town, which is where South African hip hop emerged. They actually came out around 2000, 2001, which is fairly late. But their songs, like the first song I heard of theirs was Social Ills. And they talk about being yourself and putting out unrealistic images and like not trying to keep up with that and not trying to kind of keep up with fashion, these like fashion trends, and just learning to be yourself. So those were those early messages that came out.
All right, let's turn to some of the beats from Gadessa.
So many social ills, society breeds, it's like sobriety kills the reality that feeds off the air that we breathe. There is no need to deceive, through the eye of the beholder I can see. Is it your Nike sneakers or fillers that breaches the code of conduct that features in stores? Collecting salaries like wars on low calories, both trying to marry me with fashionable jeans so expensive. Can't tell the seam apart from the need to laugh at a gift of form of art. Switch the norm from light to dark. Don't you know Adam and Eve drift leaves right from the start?
See, our hip-hop series really has shown us that everyone has a voice, everyone has a story, and sometimes those stories are heard, sometimes they're suppressed, even censored. Is there a country where there is a thriving hip-hop scene, but a country where female rappers have really struggled to get heard?
Yes, Senegal. Senegal has a very strong hip-hop scene, very rich in social commentary. The Yenamar movement there was very influential in political change. But when it came to releasing music, you didn't see women rappers engaging in that way. So even though they may have been on the ground, they weren't doing so through their music.
What about Jamaica? I mean, we've heard from up-and-coming young toasters there who are women and, you know, with things to say, but they also perform in a place that is very macho. How is that working in Jamaica?
That's a really great question. I think the universal experience of women MCs is having to confront misogyny and patriarchy. Hip-hop itself is a very misogynistic space. It's a very sexist space. So you have to navigate hip-hop's culture. Then you have to navigate kind of local cultures. And so whether you're talking about a South Africa or a Jamaica or a Nigeria, you're also navigating very kind of misogynistic, patriarchal structures and institutions. And it makes it very, very difficult. So when a woman decides to get into hip hop on her own terms, she's already challenging those structures. One of the things that women are doing now, they're rejecting the FemC label, and they just want to be recognized as MCs, period.
Talk to me nice.
Well, Frida Amani from Tanzania certainly addresses these very issues. Here's her tune, Talk to Me Nice.
Tafta pesa tukujua weni nani mini Frida. I've been disgraced, yoni shida, shida. Ni unexpect you lalom you a Frida. Bus tense, ni mechen so kawaida. I only talk kama kuna faida. Yes, niko busy sina muda. Yes, unanijua ila so kiundani buda. Usteke cheke sana yama tani divyo na vyo feel buda. Muda huna jona mimi tu kwa kio. Nikiongeza na yangu ego. It's how I fly ego. Blast kinoma ulipo mimi sipo. Stars and Leo. Attitude heavy divyo nipo. I don't play game la ushini kama nipo. Talk to me nice. Cause I be cold as ice.
Professor Clark, I mean, you just hit on this in some subgenres of hip hop. It's misogynistic, even violent toward women. There's also the flip side that hip hop has been empowering for many female rappers. I know you're a fan of Sampa the Great from Zambia. Tell us about her.
Sampa is, Zambian. She did her undergrad in the U.S. Then she moved to Australia. She won a couple ARIA awards in Australia. and is living in Botswana, I believe now, but has written a lot of songs, not only celebrating being a woman, but also celebrating being African. I think one of the narratives that isn't talked about as much is the experience of the African in the diaspora. So I was born in Tanzania, and coming to America and experiencing kind of anti-African sentiments. And so what it's like to be an African in America and the sense of loneliness that's there and kind of finding community, artists like Sampa the Great like represent that for African women immigrants. I think I connected to her a lot because of these multi-layered intersecting identities. I'm Tanzanian, I'm African, I'm American, I'm all of these things. And so I think Sampa represents that, which is why her music is also resonating with so many people.
Yeah, yeah, you already know. 1, 2, 3, 4, let's go. From LSK, you bet it, we don't play. My sister, my friends won't stay. And you know we got the power. Anything we're dreaming is ours. What's coming, what's running, exit. We super, don't stay in our lane. We don't play, we don't play. You're gonna know.
Sampa the Great there, and the title track to the Netflix series, Super Team 4. This is a series, a superhero story about girls' strength and African ingenuity. I mean, it does really fit into the theme we're talking about, Sia. I'm wondering, is that double hit of feminist culture coincidental, or is there kind of an intentional cross-fertilization between media, like film and music, among these women creators?
No, I think it's very intentional. I think that, you know, women nowadays, you know, are very intentional about their messaging and understanding the importance of kind of cross platforms and having a lot of content coming out that is addressing, you know, or has a lot of these messages in it. So I think it's a great thing that's happening. I think that some artists also produce short, because I think Sampa the Great has a short, I think, documentary or something that goes along with some of her music. And so there's this like whole visual art piece that goes along with her music. So I think, yeah, a lot of that part is intentional.
What country right now are you looking at, a place that's really bubbling up with the female rap artists of the future?
If I had to pick one and it wasn't South Africa, then it would probably be Ghana or Kenya. You know, I probably would have said Nigeria, but Afrobeats really has kind of taken over Nigeria. So I would say for hip hop, probably Ghana or Kenya would be the other two places.
All right, let's listen to Happy by Monsky from Kenya.
When the devil comes around, trying to get you down, trying to make you frown. Telling my truth to be happy.
Choice.
I choose happy.
Better yourself. Give a dream a chance. Bet on yourself. Do what you love, then you better your health. Circles keep bow, but badu kuset. Wali block gold ball, badu kwanet. My vampire, suckers trying to suck my entire. But like an umpire, I got my eyes on the game. Won't let them see my flame. Walking a smile on my face, I see the real from the fakes.
Finally, as you look around the world, has global hip-hop been its best self for women as opposed to its American iterations? And have women successfully flipped the script, do you think?
Yes. I think globally, hip-hop has done a lot more for women than what it has done for women in the U.S. That it has been a much more positive influence, that women are able to really use hip-hop as a form of empowerment much more outside of the U.S. and much more globally than they are in the U.S., which I know is, you know, for some controversial. I know that American hip hop is very American centered, and most Americans are not familiar with hip hop outside of America. But I think the most innovation happening right now in hip hop is happening outside of America. And that's, you know, it's just the truth.
Well, we really thank you for shedding some light on the artists we have not heard about, we don't know, and now we do. Professor Siya Kubona-Clark is Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of African Studies at Howard University in Washington. Great to meet you, and thanks so much for your insight.
Thank you.
Yo, styling on the look, I've been around and I'm still here. I've been a thug and I'm still queen. From the dead, but I stay clean. And I know the hate that I stay lit. For 4 years, man, I laid low. Get somebody get a chance to blow. I got the lamanj and badjan kashan and jang on bobo. But look, buzz, I'm a king, but strap hell young. What tinta mina, what tinta bogot. What linga mina, but voice I'm a tongue. Shish.
This is Zimbabwe's Awakiwa with her song Ngeke Bengemele.
As well as the end up, double boss, the level is high, and one of the summer particular bamba.
If you like the music you've been hearing in our Planet Hip Hop Summer Series, check out the playlist we've put together, which includes music from amazing rappers across the globe. You can find it wherever you follow us on social media. This week marks 6 months since massive earthquakes killed nearly 60,000 people in southern Turkey and northern Syria. Much of the rubble has not yet been cleared from places like Antakya, an historic Turkish city that suffered some of the most severe losses. Most residents are still living in tents and converted shipping containers. But little by little, small pockets of normal life are beginning to return. The World's Duri Buscarin takes us inside the city's historic bazaar.
In Antakya's old city, piles of stones now mark the foundations where homes stood for centuries. But turn a corner into the remains of the central bazaar, and the city comes to life. A street musician plays for tips as retirees set up backgammon on stools outside a tea house. The rubble of a collapsed mosque sits behind a metal barrier, and the roof of the covered bazaar is missing in some places. But a baker hands out samples of sesame cookies known as kombe, still warm from the oven. Everyone is starting to reopen day by day, says Munever Fansa. Her six-month-old son Yavuz smiles a big, toothless grin when he sees someone new. Yavuz was born just 15 days before the earthquake, Fansa says. On February 6th, they were able to escape their home before it collapsed. They took shelter with their relatives in a village an hour away. But there was no electricity, running water, or heat, and the baby got sick, Fansa says. She took Yavuz and his two siblings to a different city for a few months, but returned to Antakya to help her family run the bakery. She says most of her customers are also new returnees. We lost so much, and we have so much pain. But we're trying to keep this place alive, Fansa says, because there's nowhere else to go. We lost our past, so we have to move forward. Antakya's covered bazaar sits in the heart of the old city, where the stone buildings and latticed windows once showcased the architectural styles of the communities that built it. Christians, Muslims, and Jews coexisted here for centuries, but now their homes, businesses, and places of worship are largely destroyed. Mustafa Guler, a tinsmith, uses a hammer to shape sheets of metal into cylinders used to roast nuts and chickpeas. In Turkish, his surname means the one who smiles, but he says he's never known a pain like this one. Guler lost 57 members of his family in the earthquake, including his son and his teenage grandchildren, who were trapped under the rubble. Rescue crews couldn't reach Antakya in time, and they died before he could save them. I could hear their voices, Guler says. They were saying, Dad, Grandpa, but there was no one to help. Guler gave himself 40 days to mourn. Then he reopened his shop. Guler says he's working because he needs to earn an income. At night, he sleeps in a tent camp where 300 people share one toilet. Water deliveries come in on trucks, and there's rarely enough. But here at his shop, life takes on a familiar rhythm, one that feels connected to the past. His grandfather opened the store in 1939, Guler says, making the tin sconces that once helped illuminate the nearby Kurtuluş Street. Old customers drop by to greet him with a smile. Goulart is known as the guy who'll sit for a long chat or resize a sentimental ring for no charge. If I can do anything that makes someone smile, this is my biggest happiness, he says. But in Antakya, happiness is a rare thing these days. Instead, a sense of grief pervades almost every corner of the city. It's very sad, but there's nothing else to do, says Sabah Jontürk, who's buying vegetables and fresh cheese for breakfast at the bazaar. She and her sister Kadye, who waits in line with her, were relatively lucky. Their home survived the quake, and they've been able to live there instead of in a tent. They choose to do their shopping in local markets instead of grocery stores, and they believe strongly that Antakya and the entire Hatay region will recover. We will believe this to the end, Jontürk says. We'll never give up on Hatay. This is the cradle of civilization, and we don't want to lose it, she says. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Antakya, Southern Turkey.
There's a sense of mystery around North Korea, the so-called Hermit Kingdom, that inspires fascination around the world. For years, North Korean officials have profited from that mystique by opening restaurants overseas in Southeast Asia, places where curious customers can not just eat, but also meet actual North Koreans, the waitresses, who also sing and dance. But now many of these overseas North Korean restaurants are closing. The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following this story from Bangkok. Patrick, I know you visited these restaurants yourself. What are they like?
They are ostensibly about food. So they sell bulgogi and cold noodles with kimchi. But what they're actually selling is proximity to North Korean entertainers. And they're located in China and Southeast Asia, cities like Bangkok, Hanoi, and in countries like Laos and Cambodia. And you go in there, and the waitresses and the performers, they're always women, always with a very immaculate, polished appearance, playing guitar and keyboard and performing very well-known songs. So that is, of course, Country Roads by John Denver. I recorded that on my iPhone at a North Korean restaurant in Myanmar about 7 years ago. They do Beatles songs, too. Mostly they sing these very operatic Korean anthems, and they dance. I've seen in Bangkok North Korean hostesses making everyone get up from their seats and form a conga line, or picking some guy out of the crowd and waltzing around the room with him. So it's quite a show.
So I can see why these places attract visitors. Why are they closing down?
There's a couple factors. They're tourist traps, and for the last few years, COVID-19 has eviscerated travel. As we all know, people have been in their homes. They haven't been out and about. And so these North Korean restaurants / cabaret halls have suffered, just like a lot of restaurants. The other big factor is around the time COVID hit, the United Nations ordered all countries to expel North Korean workers. These sanctions aren't very well enforced, so some of the restaurants have hung on after that. But it does pressure countries to say to North Korean restaurant managers, it is time to rein it in. And from what I've gathered, Carol, just from calling restaurants and also relying on NK News, which is an outlet that's also been covering this, it looks like at least half, if not 80% of the North Korean restaurants in Southeast Asia have closed down. The exception seems to be in Laos, a small country that does not have very good rule of law. There is one restaurant operating there still.
Now, I got to ask, the money earned by these restaurants, where does it go?
From what we know, so this is based on defector statements and South Korean intelligence reports, the restaurants in their heyday, like 2015, 2016, would pull in $10 million per year, and that money would flow through the local North Korean embassy and end up back in Pyongyang in a slush fund. So from that slush fund, they might pay for everything from hospitals to buying luxury goods for leaders to financing the weapons program. And that's why South Korea's government has said to its citizens, don't go to these places when you're out traveling in Southeast Asia. You are possibly funding a nuclear bomb. But from my experience, South Koreans are some of the main customers because this is their only chance to mingle with someone from the other side. And I guess they'll have to get that thrill some other way now.
So what do these restaurant closures mean for the North Koreans who've been working at them?
Yeah, presumably they would go back to North Korea, and these women are generally plucked from the regime's entertainment divisions, which trains young girls from an early age to exalt and praise the regime through song or by playing instruments. You can find human rights groups calling them slaves. It is true that they have no personal autonomy, even when they're located in other cities throughout the world, but by North Korean standards, they are in enviable positions. They're usually from high-status families, so they'll probably go back to a relatively high-status life in North Korea. Also, when they were working in these restaurants overseas, they got to keep some of their money. Their family got to keep some of their money, so that would be taken away from them.
Do we know what their lives were like in these cities when they were, you know, when they were off the clock? Could they sort of wander around relatively freely? Or is the idea that if they were working overseas in one of these restaurants, they were also sort of monitored?
No, we know a lot about that. They were heavily monitored. They could not roam freely. So, for example, at one of the North Korean restaurants I visited in Bangkok, it was right beside one of the most dazzling shopping malls in the city. The women who were in that restaurant were not allowed to walk two blocks to that mall. They usually, in these restaurants, will live in a dorm-like space above the restaurant or very close by, and they are assigned to monitor each other. So if one person does something that is untoward towards the regime or does something that's slightly disloyal, they would be required to report that to their supervisor. And their supervisor would be somebody connected directly to the government, usually somebody operating out of the local North Korean embassy who's doubling as a restaurant manager, serving patrons and overseeing these women as they perform for tourists.
The World's Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Carol.
Calling all stargazers, get ready for a spectacular light show. Any excuse to play David Bowie's Space Oddity, right? Well, this weekend, from Saturday into Sunday, the Perseid meteor shower will be at its peak. And it's better than usual this year because the moon will only be 7% illuminated, so not a lot of light in the sky. That means you can see more meteors, like 100 meteors an hour. NASA has some tips for the best ways to watch.
Just find yourself a safe, dark spot to lie down with your feet pointing roughly toward the northeast and look straight up. The best time to view them is between midnight and dawn.
Not a night owl? Don't worry. You'll still be able to see something around 10 o'clock at night, provided you're in the northern hemisphere. So to our friends in Sydney or Cape Town, I'll send you a video. Fun fact: meteor showers happen when the Earth's orbit intersects with the orbit of a comet. In this case, it's the Swift-Tuttle comet. When comets travel, they leave behind a trail of rocky material. Take it away, NASA.
Earth sweeps through the comet's debris trail every year about this same time, resulting in the annual shower.
Little bits of debris race through the Earth's atmosphere, generating lots of heat. The heat vaporizes and lights up the debris as it falls, creating fiery and colorful streaks in the sky. You might know them as shooting stars, but really, it's comet leftovers getting torched. And the Perseid shower is widely regarded as the best one of the year. So grab your bug spray and a blanket, head out of the city, lie back, and enjoy the show. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here on Monday.
From PRX.